My name is Judy Esmond, and this is a session on peacemaking, the first session. And I'll be doing this session and the next one. And Bill will be discussing the books that he's mentioned, I guess. What I'm here to do is to present an aspect of the peacemaking thrust that you want to talk about, and it's the area that I mentioned when I first visited your group, and that is to spend a little time talking about what goes on inside of us as we talk about peace and war, not just the information about what's happening in the world situation. So, it seems like early in the morning to be doing this, doesn't it? Oh, no. But I think we can ease into it. I come out to this, I think, primarily as out of my background as a counselor. I noticed when people would work in their counseling sessions on the things that seemed to disturb them about themselves. What I noticed was that they seemed to work through that and then develop eyes that were more wide open to the world. In other words, they seemed to move from their personal concerns and the things that were going on internally to the outward and became more interested in that and more active. And that was curious to me. I didn't expect people to that to be a consequence of people working on their emotions about a variety of things, and yet it seemed to be. And the more I've read about that, the more other people are saying that too. Even in books that we have in the bookstore in the library that discuss peacemaking, some of the authors include sections on the emotions, on feelings that go on inside of us. And I just wanted to point out a couple of them to you. There's more, and I'll bring them the next time. You also get a bookseller as well as a teacher here. A Handbook for World Peacemakers. This is a little bitty dollar book by Cosby and Price, and they explain about how to lead a peacemaking group and how to lead such a thing. And one of the things they talk about is two things, an inward journey and an outward journey as people begin to be peacemakers or continue to be peacemakers, and that both the inner responses and the outer actions are important to look at, and that there's a balance between them. I'm going to read you a quick little thing if I haven't lost it. They have a commitment for their peacemaking groups. For the inward journey, I commit myself to search for an ever-deepening understanding and appropriation of Christ's gift of inner security and peace. I recognize that this entails a serious journey inward until the sources of fear and violence within me are touched and understood and a new beginning. And there is a new beginning. And then they talk about the outward journey. I commit myself to search for ways of encouraging our nation and other nations to change their path and build a nation built on spiritual truth and so on. But there's an acknowledgement that what goes on inside of us is as important as what we do. The same with this book, Peacemaking Family Activities for Peace and Justice. They're activities to do with young people. Sunday school teachers might enjoy something like this. One of the aspects that they think is important is for children to begin to talk about what goes on inside of them in relation to each other, like how we're different, and begin to appreciate that and acknowledge that that's okay to be different from one another, for instance. Or when they have conflict between themselves, how do they handle that and what feelings come up and so on. So those kinds of things, I think, point us in this direction. A book that I've used quite a bit of, and we also have in the bookstore in the library, is Despair and Personal Power in the Nuclear Age, written by Joanna Rogers Macy. She's a teacher of world religions who has also done some psychotherapy, and what she has done is pulled her information together to suggest that there is actually a method that people can use if they want to in groups to move toward political action, for instance, or show social change and still support each other emotionally. So bits and pieces of what she's got I'm going to give to you today. Okay, this is what I want to say. I'm going to say a few things to you, and then I'd like you to do some discussing among yourselves about this, and then have us all talk together about what we discover. I would imagine that in this group, we have different points of view about peace war issues. I would think that we, as individuals, have different ideas about what the causes are, where the blame should be put, who is responsible, and what the solutions are. I would think we have differences about that. I suspect that when you talk later and react to the books that you're going to be reading, some of those things might come, some of those differences might come out, and I think that's good. Just as we have different points of view about what the causes are and what the solutions are, I think we also have different feelings about all of that. And what I would like to do these next two sessions is really concentrate on the feelings. So even though sometimes we might be talking about things that we may disagree with, I hope that what we pay attention to is the feelings behind that. And I'll try to help us do that. It seems to me that emotions are the things that provide the fuel for our action. I think that our feelings can be a furnace for us, and can get us going. I think, however, that feelings are not necessarily a guide to say what ought to be done. I think feelings need to be worked with. They need to be understood. They need to be discovered and understood. So just because I feel something doesn't mean I need to act on it. But because I feel something, that's a prime time to say, what's going on here? What is this about? And spend some time with it. And then see what comes out of it. I think when we do something like that, we tend to have more creative ideas. We have fresher thoughts, and we move. Now, that's all for introduction. I'm going to go back and say that several different ways throughout the next 2 days, and hopefully that will make sense to each of you. What I'd like to do to get us started is to have you do a little bit of thinking about yourself right now, about what... I'll just tell you what I want you to do, and then we'll pull it apart a little bit. I'd like you to get together... I'm going to count 2, 4, 6, 11, 12. Sandy, do you want to join this talking together? Okay, great. Then we have four groups of threes, which is what I would like you to be in, is trios, for 5 to 10 minutes. It won't take long. And I'd like you to be with people that you don't usually discuss things with. So if you're kind of getting to know each other and you have conversations frequently, or rather you've picked other people to be with. And then I'm going to tell you what I would like you to talk about. So first, could you get in your trios? I'm going to give you two questions to respond to out loud with each other. You can do it as smoothly as possible. I know you talk to everybody. Okay, you talk to Amy. And Sandy's new blood here, so. Now, are you? Yes, you are. Okay. You might want to turn a little bit more inward so you just don't hear each other and it's real confusing. Now, is Dan in this?
Well,
yes,
but it's been a lot of time talking to you.
Yeah, but we need a third person. Okay. I'm going to ask you two questions. And what I'd like you to do is think about them for a minute and then answer them to each other out loud. And as you do that, I'd like the person who's speaking to go ahead and say all you want to say, and the people who are listening to really just listen, not to respond, not to say something back, particularly if you don't agree, or it's not a time for conversation, it's a time for listening to the other person. And I hope that the person who's talking can really relax enough to think it through and to talk out loud and let these other people in on it. And those that are listening, spend some time in your mind thinking, what are the feelings behind this? What is this person feeling? Why is this important to them? Here are the questions. I'm going to ask you two questions about the United States. And I'd like you to take them seriously. By that I mean I'd like you to really find an answer to both questions. So some of you may have to search a bit, but I hope you find an answer. It can be small or big, whatever. The first question, they're both simple. The first question is, what do you love, really love, about the United States? What's something you really love about this country? Okay, I'll just give you that, and I'll stop you in about 4 or 5 minutes, and then I'll give you the second question. Okay, what do you really love about the United States? What is something, what I'd like you to talk about is something that's happened recently. Well, but I mean is not historically over the years, but something that's happened in this recent history, yesterday and a little further back, that's brought you some pain about this. What feelings did you notice yourself and other people having about what they were talking about?
Despair.
Despair?
He was feeling kind of drained.
Mm-hmm. I'm just going to write these down. Drained.
Emotionally drained.
Uh-huh.
Not power going out.
Powerless, maybe?
Yeah.
What other feelings did you notice yourself?
Mm-hmm.
Anger? Pride.
Hope.
Your feelings.
Fear.
Grief.
Solidarity or agreement.
Unity. Solidarity. Any other emotion that you noticed in yourself or in the other people? Mm-hmm. Betrayal. Mm-hmm. Trust. Betrayal.
Consciousness,
you notice that people...
An awareness of all really uncomfortable. Kind of an overall feeling of...
An awareness of others? Of,
yes.
A compassion, would you call that?
Compassion.
Mm-hmm. Those are feelings that I think are pretty typical for the questions that I gave you and for the people that you are. I think the feelings that most peacemaking groups would end up dealing with or discovering the most would be the anger and the fear and the sadness. And I would add another one that none of you have said, but I know that I feel it when I talk about that, and that's guilt. Some kind of implication in all of this for me, or some collusion on my part. How did it feel to talk to each other about this? What feelings did you feel in sharing? So, Bill said solidarity, so I assume that that's part of that, but and compassion. But what else? Did you feel any other feelings in discussing it?
Well, I guess for me it was the first question. There was almost a sense of, I haven't thought about that for so long. Am I supposed to feel good about my country? Is that kind of... almost a fear of sharing what it is that makes me feel good about it. Because we spend so much time in our fear and anger about what is happening in the context of this it's almost like I'd be betraying the discussion if the group talked about what's really needed.
How did you feel then as you did talk about what you
I felt really good. You know, there are some wonderful things about the country that I really love. I'm glad I live here because of those things, but it was still that. I remember growing up, and that was the focus. Mm-hmm. This wonderful country, and pride and patriotism, and really feeling okay about all of those things, and not feeling so okay about them anymore. Because of what they do to other people. You know, there's still some things that I do love about this country.
Mm-hmm. It's said that anyone can build if they have the money, the most beautiful house and everything they want, and just the way they want it. And they move in, and the next day they find something they want to change. Suddenly you're a country.
Can we love something and still want it to be different?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's related to that was the intergenerational here, that to hear Agnes has so much more sense of pride in this country that for I think some of us we've lived with such disillusionment, you know, that we maybe, you know, we need to talk across generations.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think the same thing goes when you talk with young children. They have a lot of pride and we can pick that up from them too. Yeah. Other feelings that you had about just about sharing this yourself a little bit with each other? How did that feel not to be able to think of something right away? I think that can be a powerful question. I think for people of your generation that it's there's a lot of sadness about the difficulty in finding that for some people.
Sadness about not being proud.
Yeah.
Oh, it's fun to be proud of your country.
Yeah. Yes, it is.
Lisa? About a week ago, I was trying to tell you not from this country. And then my feelings of pride came up much more because they didn't have anything good to say about it. And my question was, okay, what are you here for? Mm-hmm. What are you saying?
Mm-hmm.
It's so bad.
Mm-hmm. And it forced you to start thinking of what's valid. valuable here.
The first thing I thought of was to be thinking, I mean, when you asked the question, the first thing I thought of was when a group of American visitors to the Soviet Union this last summer, when a plane took off the ground, a number of people broke into applause. That we were relieved to leave that country. People very, you know, open to being there and to dialogue and peacemaking. But the sense of appreciation for America that we got from 2 weeks in Soviet Union was just powerful. Just powerful. And the pilot announced that we are now, you know, an hour later, now leaving Soviet airspace again. Almost the whole plane cheered. And these were all liberal Democrats.
Yeah. It's ours. When people begin to talk about what troubles them about the world, these kinds of things, emotions surface. And I think under all of these is this one that Agnes mentioned, that compassion we have for each other and for the world. And this is another thing I want to back up as a what I've noticed as psychologically with people, is that when people begin to look at themselves individually and do some emotional work around the things that disturb them, and then they move out of that somehow, what also happens is not only eyes that open wider, but a real sense of compassion for the rest of the world. And I think sometimes those of us that want people or try to help people do emotional counseling is that we think that only emotional counseling occurs in this small little arena about talking about ourselves only. And I think very often people move to begin to talk about the rest of the world and the pain that they have about it and how we suffer for the rest of the world. And that's a part of us, emotionally, psychologically, spiritually. And that kind of compassion ties us together. I think it brings us into unity, no matter where we're coming from with that. But unless we talk on that level, sometimes we don't notice that. And we start talking at each other about our ideas. And we get caught in that. And it's hard to feel together. It's hard to feel united. And we end up feeling, I think, isolated. And that we have to carry it all alone and on our own shoulders. And I want to talk more about that particular kind of thing, what the consequences of all this is on us on Thursday. Right now I want to continue to talk about the feelings that happen to us right now as we face world problems. Now I want to back up even further because there's this neat little thing I want to say that I didn't say before. If I were a skeptic, I'd be sitting there saying, emotions can be a waste of time if we talk about them very much, or they'll stop us. You know, they'll sort of put the brakes on our work. If I spend time feeling about this, I've just got to keep going. Okay? I've heard that before. And I want to say that I think if you think about yourself or about people you know, you'll see that it works in a different way. I remember a while ago having a broken love affair, and it broke against my wishes. And I spent, I think, an inordinate amount of time thinking about that. How did that happen? What could I have done? Why did he do that? Where is he now? I hope he's dead. That kind of horrible stuff. And I feel like, and I think I did spend a good year at least doing that. And I talked to my friends about that. And whenever they would say, well, how's so-and-so? Or have you heard from so-and-so? Or how are you doing? I would say the same stuff over and over and over again about that. That's where I was. That's all I could say. And it wasn't until beyond that or later than that that I began to let some of the other feelings besides the anger and the confusion. And mostly what I let out was the fear about what that said about me, why that relationship stopped, what was it about me, and I let that fear out, and I let the more sadness out about that. And as I did that, I talked about it differently. I began to see other men differently, and I became much more energetic in general about my life. And I think that happens to us when we talk about world problems too, when we talk about politics too. If we don't allow ourselves to feel all that it is under that for us, we talk about it the same way, we see it the same way, we have a broken record kind of thing. People know exactly what we're going to say when we start to talk about such and such. And I think sometimes it feels like that's the only way we have to think about it. And some of us, and I think I felt that way with my love affair, was that if I don't talk about it this way, I'll lose it. I won't ever have that, I won't have that relationship anymore. I won't have that connection with this man. Well, I do. I still have that connection with the man, but it's a very different one than I had a year after the relationship broke up, or 2 years after it did, and 3 years after it did. But it's bigger and broader and, I think, more healthy. And I think the same thing goes for us as people who want to be politically and socially active. We can get going on a track unless we keep feeling what's underneath. Okay. You might mull that over a little bit and then we can talk about it tomorrow or next time sometime. Can I switch gears or did you want to say anything about that? Okay. What I'd like to do now is just mention to you what I think are, and other people have come to accept as reasons why we don't want to look at and discuss and share the feelings behind what we think. Is there something about the world situation that you really avoid thinking about? You know that as soon as it comes up, boom, you don't want to talk about it. You don't want to think about it. Is there something like that? So there's something about you, there's something you don't want to notice. Okay, it could be something inside. It could be. It sounds like you've got some anger about that.
I do. Yeah. It doesn't just sound like it.
Yeah. Well, some of the things you're talking about are what we could call defenses. We defend ourselves against our feelings inside. I think people act them out in all kinds of ways, and what I want to do is just give you a list of the way that we act those out. And I think we'll see ourselves in that, and I think we'll see other people. And the reason that I do it at all is because I want to honor those defenses somewhat. I think none of us are open books emotionally. We all have pages and chapters that are closed, and we open them when we can. And I guess I'm encouraging us to open that book a little bit more as we think politically and socially than sometimes we have to do. But I also want to acknowledge that those defenses are there, and ourselves and each other, and we need to be respectful of those. Not we need to respect the defense, but we need to respect each other, and that there's a reason sometimes why it's harder for some of us to push against one thing than another, or to allow ourselves space from the hunger, the famine, you know, or allow ourselves such and such, and yet know that we can go back to that and say, well, what's the next piece of that I need to uncover that will allow me to do that? So, one of the things that we've said already is, for defenses, is we don't want to feel the pain. And I think that's fairly common. And the trap is that we can stop feeling anything and become what looks like indifferent when we're not at all. We feel blocked. I do the same thing with torture of innocent people. I can't look at a magazine. I can't read an article about torture. I can hardly pick it up. I just don't want to know. And it's that I think the pain will overwhelm me so much that I'll just, I don't know, I'll explode or I'll faint or I just won't be or something. It just feels horrible. I think another reason that we don't talk about this and we don't allow the feelings up and share them, I think it's important to share them because this stuff is so isolating, is that we're afraid of being morbid. Oh no, here she goes again, talking about that. Well, you know, at the very least, we perceive that we're a wet blanket to the group if we start talking about this. And the worst is that, you know, that we're just this prophet of doom. Oh, and feeling labeled as that kind of a person. The defense that I have that stops me from talking about it is I feel stupid. I think I come from a family or a group that said that if you have a complaint, if there's something you don't like, that's all well and good and you can bring it up, but you ought to have a solution to it. So don't just complain about it. What are you going to do about it? Well, I feel dumb. Like, well, I know I don't like such and such, but I'm not sure I can think of a solution right now, particularly if it's a solution to a world problem. So I keep quiet, period. I don't even want to think about it for myself because then I immediately say to myself, well, what's the answer? Does anybody else have that? Yeah? Right. And that, you know, and I think that ties in with feeling like we have to be in control too. Guilt is something I mentioned before, and I think we do have guilt, and I think the country, our nation has guilt. There's a general sense that we somehow collude in the world's problems, that half the world not having enough to eat has something to do with us. And we know, in fact, it has something to do with us, but I think we have, even at guilt when we take the food into our mouth and we eat, you know, what coffee am I drinking this time? Where did this banana come from? And we just can feel that, and we don't want to feel it, and particularly don't want to feel it if we feel like we have to be responsible to solve it, so it's better not to look.
I don't know, I always have that reaction when I look at time, usually pictures of people who are hungry. That reaction always comes to me. I always feel very guilty, and I always have images of us as being very fat, overindulgent people. And that, you know, I know we try to solve it. The image comes up, well, why isn't it getting solved? I mean, is the problem being solved at all? The problem still seems to be there. It seems to be getting worse. And then, well, are we really trying hard enough? So built from that too.
And then we can ask ourselves, am I really trying to work? Am I doing everything I can do?
Yeah.
And I think when we start to think that way, we get overwhelmed.
Yeah.
And then we don't want to hear about it, we don't want to think about it anymore for a while.
That blocks me from reading about it sometimes because I know that's going to come up.
I'm going to tie this again at the bottom, so I hope we'll come out of it after we talk about it. It's not uncommon. I think that's why I'm writing these down, so that we realize that we're not alone in having these reactions. I think another reason that we don't bring things up is we don't want to cause other people pain by bringing it up. We don't want to make, when we already feel bad, we don't want to make other people feel bad. I think parents do that, or adults do that with children. We don't want to bring this up in front of them, because then they'll start to feel bad, and they should have a happy life and a carefree life, and, you know, or that kind of thing. Or I don't want to bring it up in front of their mother, you know, and I shook it up down, or something like that. We don't want to do that. Same with the group. We don't want to bring it down.
we care for each other. We don't want to cause pain. We also don't want to provoke disaster, and some of us think that, you know, that our thoughts can come true. It's a self-fulfilling prophecy sort of thing. So if I start to think about what's happening with nuclear weapons and what could actually happen, my gosh, what, maybe it would happen. I can sow the seed. We've already implied this, I think, in our discussion by the tree Antic, that if we start to talk about this, we do talk about the United States, somehow it's bound to come up when we talk about world problems. And if we at all think that something should be changed, we're afraid of being labeled or thought of as unpatriotic, or even seeing ourselves that way. And for some of us, I think we say, well, then that's how I'm going to be thought of, and we never give ourselves room to say the other side, which is, I am American, and I really love such and such and such and such. For some of us, we don't bring it up because it brings up for us religious doubt. And we've talked about this in other kinds of discussions around here. But we start to look at the problem, it says to some of us, there's badness, there's evil in the world. How can there be a righteous and powerful God in the midst of this evil? How can that be? And it throws us into the question. And for some of us, we come out saying, well, there must be, or God isn't benevolent or something, if this can even happen. And I think most religions address the suffering of the world, and what they come with is that God gives us the capacity to feel with, suffer with, have compassion for the suffering in the world, and that God meets us in the suffering. That's two sentences in the sermon here, but the doubt, I think, is frightening. But I think religions have more to say to us than that. But anyway, for some, they don't want to look. Oops. In our nation, I think when we begin to talk about our feelings, in particular if we don't have a solution right on the tip of our tongue, we are afraid of being labeled too emotional. I just feel feelings, I don't need anything else. And in a rational country like the United States, it seems that's not the way to be, not to have our feelings. And even those of us that respect feelings have a hard time being with them, allowing them, being in the presence of our own feelings. That would be too much. And I think we could go a long way before we already could be too much. Also, I think in this way that we live in, we have a real attitude of separateness as individuals. And when we begin to look at all of this, it kind of goes against the grain almost to feel compassion for the rest of the world. It's like we're supposed to take care of ourselves, you know. If you just take care of yourself and you're responsible for yourself and you live a good life, that's the contribution you make. To think about the rest of the world and feel something for it kind of feels un-American, or at least it does. When I think about the family and the town I grew up in, that was the attitude. You take care of yourself. That's what you do. So to say, gee, I'm really worried about so-and-so in Africa. What are you worried about that for? The best thing you can do is be a good whatever. Worker, mother. You're nodding your head, some of you don't know that. And then I think there are other defenses, but these are the ones that I pulled out, is that we don't want to talk about this, we don't want to think about it because it makes us feel powerless. That there's nothing I can do about it, so why think about it? What can I do?
and that feels horrible on the field. And I think as people from the United States, we are prone to that because we are trained to think of ourselves as powerful and in control and the masters of our destiny. So how in the world can we ever admit or allow ourselves to feel powerless? We're not a nation too much that feels humility or humbleness. And I think when we allow ourselves to do that, to begin to feel like we don't have to have the answers to everything, we don't have to be responsible for everybody, but we may have a small idea or a small solution, and that might be what we do, I think we're going to be better off. And that's where I was responding to you, Bob, that that sense of guilt is sometimes the fact that we think we have to be responsible for it all. I think if we move to feeling what small piece we can play, we might be better off. And I'll also talk about that a bit more tomorrow too. Do you have any reactions or thoughts or additions to that list?
It's probably one of these that I meet so many people say that I have enough problems in my little world, I don't have enough energy to deal with the big problems. Mm-hmm. I found that really in the congregation. We're all just trying to hold our own lives and families together.
Right. I would say that's a consequence of these things. Mm-hmm. And that's what we'll talk about Thursday. I think there are several of those, and that's a common one.
Sometimes I just feel, and probably a defense that I use is I think I'm too ignorant, I don't know enough about the subject that I then become whatever. Mm-hmm. Or seem to myself that I'm apathetic. Mm-hmm. That's because I feel I don't know. Should be reading more.
Uh-huh. And do you believe that there's ever that you could ever know enough? Is there ever a level at which you say, "Aha, now I know enough"?
Yeah.
When you can win 90% of the arguments.
90%. About who we are and what country we live in and how and what educational background most of us have, my guess is we know enough. We know enough to act. Yeah. Unless we think we have to solve the problem. You know, unless we have to have all the power and take all the responsibility.
Except there's a community in the United States that the Pentagon, the people in the House, the Senate, the President, have information that we don't have, and how can we challenge their ability to solve the problem when they have all the information?
Mm-hmm. When they don't know.
Right. Yeah. Or they withhold it. Yeah.
I want to say something about being patriotic.
Mm-hmm.
One of the
to your comment about
sometimes believe that other people know more than us, particularly the people in the government. There's a quote here from William Hyland, who is a deputy director of the National Security Council. And he says, psychological numbing does not exist at the top levels of government. I mean, it exists for all the rest of us as we contemplate all of this, right? But not at the top levels of government. Of course, if you allow the emotion of nuclear war to enter the Defense Department, you'd end up totally paralyzed. What he's saying is if we in the Defense Department allow ourselves to have the feelings, we would be so blocked with feeling that we wouldn't be able to move. Yeah, it would be really exciting. And another quote by a British journalist named Alice Cook, lack of emotionalism in discussions about nuclear war is not a sign of reason, but is a kind of sick passivity.
Did you read that little paper that you read from Kelly Collins? She was talking about how people say you're too emotional. And she's pretty emotional when she speaks. And what she said was that his parents came into her office as a doctor, and she told them her child was dying of leukemia, and the parents weren't emotional. Then she was saying to a psychiatrist, and so how important it is, how much sense it makes to be emotional about to know to your own. You don't hear that from you.
And once again, what I would say is that those feelings are things that we should honor, and that our the first feeling, that no need to act on every feeling we have, but we can use those feelings to understand ourselves in relation to the thing we're trying to face, and then come up with it with action. You know, if I had acted on this broken love affair, I would have gone and burned this man's house down. You know, and so I know that that's not what I need to do. But if I kept working with this and working with this and working with it, I came to a different kind of understanding that was real.